We have breaking news right now out of New York. A federal appeals court has ruled that the NSA program that has collected information from billions of phone calls is illegal. Specifically, the three-judge panel ruled that current law does not authorize that kind of data collection, but the judges did not address whether the program violates the Constitution.
The absence of privacy is not the presence of security. And the presence of security is not the absence of privacy. Rather, the absence of privacy is the presence of censorship.
How's everyone doing out there? Hopefully you're doing well. Today is Friday, November 12th, 2021. It's Simon for the Closed Network Podcast, episode number 4. This episode labeled Surveillance Capitalism, aka I Have Nothing to Hide. This is a statement I've heard from many people over the last few years talking about privacy, data collection, surveillance, scanning, facial recognition, fill in the blank with whatever dystopian practice or technology we've become accustomed to be, hearing in the news and seeing. And I feel like we're finally maybe getting to a point where there's more reason to be concerned and be aware of how your data is being used, to care about it more than saying, I don't have anything to hide, so why do I care? And I'm not here to try to tell you why you should care. I think that if you're listening to this podcast, you probably do care on some level, and it's something that you're trying to work at mitigating as much exposure to your digital personal life as possible to third-party companies, corporations, governments, nation states, fill in the blanks. So I have quite a bit to cover. I'm really just going to cover kind of in a broad topic. I'm going to talk about some specific applications, things you can do to try to shield your data. Of course, this topic is pretty broad in the sense of data collection in general, both bulk collection and collection that happens from social media sites that you use for free of charge, and they are used to harvest information about you, sold to third parties, third party as in data collectors, sold directly to them, and then also sold through their publishing platforms for advertisers. So as we saw In the sense of Facebook, we saw back in 2018 during the Cambridge Analytica scandal, where they were basically scraping data and they were using it without the consent of the people that they were essentially taking it, using it on. And they were doing political advertising for, manipulation of people's emotions and their beliefs. And they were skewing a lot of perception based upon that data they had collected and what they looked at. And that kind of spawned a lot of conversations within a lot of these large tech companies, from the government to determine what kind of regulation need to be imposed. And this is been in a larger scale in other countries has been even more harsh with GDPR and things like that. So I'm not necessarily talking about metadata or personal data, like where your information lives on social platforms in this episode, but more about what I would consider more like your hard data, meaning like your files that you keep stored in the cloud. You might be using Dropbox, iCloud, OneDrive, Google Drive, any number of cloud services where you store documents and photos, music, any number of, you know, documents for whatever particular purpose. It could be personal, it could be arbitrary, it could be a shopping list that, you know, you use one time and delete, whether it's using an iCloud Notes app or something like that. But then there could also be files that you are, you know, have stored in the cloud. It could be tax documents, could be, you know, real estate documents from a closing of your house, warranty information, scans of your car's service records, literally anything. Could be transcripts from college and high school, birth certificates. You kind of want a way to back these things up somewhere where you can access them at a future date if needed. Could be a scan of your passport. Could be documents, spreadsheets of like your assets in case you were to have a fire, serial numbers of firearms, computer equipment, TV, stereos, that kind of thing. Well, it's important to know like where it lives and who technically owns it. When I say own it, I don't mean the creator of the file. I mean who owns the server, who owns the hard drive, and what does that mean for you? So with the case of like, say, Google, you might say, well, Google's a big company. I feel like they're pretty secure. They're not going to be as easy to hack to get to my data. That's true. You're probably right. Though these companies do get hacked, just Google the Fappening, FAPPENING, be careful with that. But that was back when iCloud was hacked and celebrities had their photos leaked out onto the internet. So a lot of them were very racy. And I'm sure those celebrities might, before that, have said, I don't have anything to hide because I'm not doing anything wrong. No, it's not wrong. And it's not wrong to, you know, have racy photos of you and your significant other and this and that and the other, but you don't want them shared with the world. Just because you don't have anything to hide doesn't necessarily mean that you want all of your personal data transparent and exposed for the world to see, sift through, and do with whatever they want to with. I mean, there's a huge difference between not being a drug dealer or an arms dealer and not having anything to hide, you know, from a criminal perspective versus, well, I really don't want all of that information being housed somewhere where it could be accessed by third parties, or when a third party could just be an employee at that company. Maybe someone with an axe to grind, an ex, a lover or something that, you know, could look this stuff up. So one of the things that I've been working on over the last month or month and a half is learning how to use and set up and configure Nextcloud. And I'll get a little bit more into that, but that's kind of like where I'm at right now. There are tools that you can use to encrypt your data before it goes to the cloud. So if you're not quite at that point in your journey where you're ready to set up your own infrastructure and like manage your cloud server yourself, there are things you can start doing today that will help you protect your data before it gets uploaded to whatever cloud service provider you're using. So we'll just use Dropbox in this example, or iCloud or Google Drive. Pick one, doesn't really matter. You can use applications like Cryptometer, which is an open source application. I'll have a link to this application in the show notes, and it will also be on the website. And it's an open source app that you can download and install, and it's really easy to use. Essentially, what you can do is encrypt your files in like a vault and then synchronize that to the cloud. So at least you're still using your cloud service for backup in case something happens to your mobile device or your laptop or desktop or something like that. And as long as you install Cryptometer on another device and you have the credentials, you can get unlock that vault. Think of it as just you're the only one that has the keys to that particular vault, so to speak. In this scenario, we're saying vault, but just it's a folder. It could just be a folder where you're keeping all this in there. And then, you know, that's what you're actually synchronizing to the cloud. So that's kind of like on a basic level. If you wanted to do something right now, today, and you're like, oh, geez, yeah, I do have stuff in my Dropbox that I don't really want leaked or viewed by people at work at Dropbox. So what can I do about that? Well, go ahead and encrypt the folder and then re-upload it. That's the simplest way. The next step would be to actually use using a different service, like a zero knowledge service. So I'll kind of highlight a few. And I got this list from Tech Lore, the YouTube channel Tech Lore. And they basically are a YouTube channel focused on privacy and security. They do a lot of reviews. So some of these are recommendations from their list, but also some of them are from me. One of them was Tresorit, T-R-E-S-O-R-I-T. But, it's like 10 bucks a month, billed annually. It's like 500 gigabytes of storage. These are kind of like just a replacement for storing files. It's not necessarily going to offer a lot of other modules or a suite of services that you might be used to with iCloud or Google Drive. I say Google Drive, but I kind of mean Google ecosystem. Contacts, photos, files, documents, collaboration, that kind of thing. So Tresorit, Ice Drive, which is also another zero knowledge, but you only get the zero knowledge with a paid plan. What zero knowledge means is that it's end-to-end encrypted. So when you create the account, you essentially are creating an encryption key that only you have. The service provider doesn't have any way to unlock those files, which is good. That means if there's some sort of compromised situation where their servers are hacked or there's an agency coming in and taking those servers, they can't really see your data without your encryption key. That encryption key could just be an account login and password. It could also be a passphrase. If you ever have used a Bitcoin wallet, you get what's called a seed phrase, where it's a series of words, could be anywhere from 12 to 24 different words that are essentially unlocking the vault. I've also used pCloud. pCloud is, I'm not promoting them, by the way. I've been using them for a couple years. They are a zero knowledge end-to-end encrypted. I'll double check that. I'm pretty sure they're end-to-end encrypted, but they're kind of a lesser known provider for kind of like being able to mount a folder to your file system within your operating system, whether it's Mac, Linux, Windows, whatever, as like it's another folder in your file browser that you can basically save files to, and it automatically goes to that destination. So in the event of something happening to your system, you can just go onto another system, install the software, log into the browser, get back to those documents. No big deal. Proton Drive is a newer one. I do have Proton Drive, but I haven't used it a whole lot. It's still in beta as we speak. But Proton is kind of known for Proton Mail, Proton VPN. And what they're working on with Proton Drive is kind of more of a suite, kind of like a direct competitor to Google, where you can store your contacts, your documents. It handles your email. You have your VPN set up there. And I think that's pretty cool. And I think for a lot of people, that could be something to consider. There are other kind of suites out there as well, but Proton's the one I have some familiarity with because I've used Proton Mail for quite a long time. But I also am not super jazzed about the idea of having all my data with any one particular entity. I'm okay with them doing my email. And one of my next steps in that is doing my own email domain and continuing to use Proton Mail, but rather than a Proton Mail email address, I have an email address that's under a domain that I can control, because then I can always move that domain to a different email provider. There's no guarantee that Proton Mail will exist forever. There's no guarantee that your files will always be accessible with Google or Apple. They have, issues, downtime sometimes, and they don't happen very often, but they do happen. And you're relying on them. They own your data. They can decide, for whatever reason down the road, if there's some violation of their terms of service, they can nuke your account. These are things that keep me up at night, and they should keep you up. Again, you're thinking, I don't do anything wrong. I would never be. Well, you don't know what might happen down the road. You might become more politically involved with something. You might become part of an organization that's part of a whistleblower. Anything can happen. You can't read into the future. If you could, you'd probably be doing other things like making lots of money. So what I've, you know, as I've been going through all of these different processes of kind of like taking my data back, pulling it off of different cloud providers I've had them hosted with over the years, it's kind of made me like reevaluate where my data lives and in which platforms, and how can that be used. And remember, if you're not paying for this service, you are the product. And on top of that, even if you are paying for it, that company, organization, still has the ability to look at that content and match it against whatever they want. You know, they're going to say they're scanning it to make sure you're not uploading anything deemed illegal or something like that. Well, I mean, understandable. They're going to have to abide by certain laws and regulations, but they are looking at it. Now, not a person, but machines are looking at it. They're scanning it. Google's definitely looking at this stuff. Part of it is also because they kind of have to support all the services they offer. So if you have documents stored in Google Drive and you want the ability to be able to search for something, that a keyword that might live in a document or multiple documents, it has to index. It has to keep an index of all that content in a database so that it can provide that search result feature to you. So it's kind of this double-edged sword thing where it's like the more features you get used to and like, the more you have to realize how much more you're giving up for those ability, you know, those features to exist. So, you know, when you start like looking at all these things and dissecting, you're kind of start getting like, okay, you know, again, if you are listening, you probably care enough to know like, well, what are my options, right? So the simplest option is one I had just mentioned, using something like Cryptomator to encrypt your files before they're actually uploaded. The next is to just use a zero trust service provider to store those documents and files. I'll just call them files because it could be anything. It could be music files, could be movies, could be, you know, archived family video footage. It could be any number of things. So what's the next stage? Is to self-host it yourself. And that's the path that I'm going down now. I've been running my own Nextcloud server. My brother and I have both been using it for a lot of things that I'll get into in just a moment. But I first want to say there's a couple ways that you can do this. There are, you know, packages you can download and install to run on your own computer, whether it's maybe a Raspberry Pi. You could run it as a Docker image, which is like a virtual server, so to speak, and that can be run in all different kinds of environments. You could also host it on a virtual private server, which is one of the things that I'm testing right now on Linode, which is a virtual private service company. So you can pay like, you know, $5-$10 a month to have your own server and set everything you want up on there. You can also use a service that there's tons of them out there that you can actually Google Nextcloud service host or something like that. And there's going to be a lot of service providers out there. Again, you're relying on them for uptime. You're relying on them, but you can also set up your Nextcloud server to have end-to-end encryption. It's not set up by default, but you can set up end-to-end encryption, and you can also set up SSL. So you can make it very secure, even if you're paying someone else to host the server for you. The difference is, though, is that you just have a relationship with that service provider for your infrastructure versus a relationship with something like Google or Apple or Microsoft that basically they get to store it, they get to scan it, and do all whatever they want to it. And they can lock you out. If they really wanted to, they could lock you out. Let's say you don't pay your bill for a while. If you have Apple iCloud, they may not lock you out entirely, but you're going to have some issues. You're going to have some problems accessing it. So, you know, you're kind of beholden to the subscription model to your data. So you don't even own your own files is kind of what we're moving to. And I'm trying to help people move back the other direction where it's like, no. I own it. I house it. I store it. And I manage it. It's a lot more responsibility because you have to think about backups. You have to think about data loss if something, hard drive goes bad or something like that. But, I mean, like, these are the trade-offs. The pros and cons. If you pay a subscription every month, it's somebody else's problem. But if it's your really important content, maybe it should be your problem. And that's kind of where I'm at with all of this, is that it's important enough to me to actually deal with some of the pains. And but at the same time, it's also a fun experiment. And I say experiment because I've tried it a couple different ways and different things before I finally figured out how I want to set it up. All the while, my data is still living where it's always lived, either in whatever one of three or four different cloud services where they stay. Now that I actually have my system set up, I'm moving stuff over. I'm starting with Dropbox, moving that over to my next cloud instance, my next cloud account, and I'm then deleting the stuff out of Dropbox. Now, I do know that, you know, there's probably a record of that somewhere stored. I know that once I delete them, they're maybe not really deleted from Dropbox, but, you know, I'm just doing what I can do, and I won't use it any further. So I'm actually running Nextcloud on a Linode virtual private server, and it's pretty awesome. I like that it's kind of more of a full Google Suite replacement. So I have my contacts set up there. I have my files and photos, as well as calendar, although I'm not actively using the calendar component. There's also the ability to set up collaboration. So you can create documents like Word docs, Excel docs inside of Nextcloud through the web platform, just like you would if you were logged into your Google account and you wanted to create a new document. You get the same functionality, and it actually works really, really well. You also have an instant messaging application, although it really only works within that environment, but that's kind of cool. You could have, you know, it's called Nextcloud Talk, so you can install the Talk app on your mobile device, and you could communicate with your friends and family on your own instance, your own server, without relying on a third party like WhatsApp or Signal or, you know, name any, whatever, chat, iMessage, whatever. You can kind of manage it yourself. So that's pretty neat. Though that's not a feature that, you know, won me over, it's just kind of a nice to have. And there's a lot of other apps that you can install. It's a pretty vast ecosystem. It's also open source, so the code is constantly being reviewed. It's being updated. People are writing enhancements and security fixes. So you kind of get this best of all worlds, because you get the file storage and kind of this suite along with it that offers a lot of other things. And the cool thing is that, like, for instance, the contact synchronization works on an iPhone. It works on an Android. It works on de-Googled Android devices. We've set it up both on Graphene OS, Calyx OS, and it works on regular Android. So it's very operating system agnostic. Wherever you are in your journey, this will easily integrate into your digital kind of arsenal. And I definitely am I'm a huge advocate of doing this, because it's taking back your sovereignty. You know, when I say sovereignty, I'm kind of like you owning your data again, just like cryptocurrency, you know, being your own bank. That's something we'll get into in other episodes, but I bring it up because there's another way you can set up this Nextcloud server pretty easily, and you get the benefit of it being able to set up a Bitcoin node. There is a Raspberry Pi image project. It's really a project called Get Umbrel, UMBREL, where you can download the image, flash it to an SD card, throw it into a Raspberry Pi, and depends on how long it takes to synchronize the blockchain, but within like a day or two, you could have a full Bitcoin node running. The cool thing is that it also has a web interface to one-click install applications. One of those applications happens to be Nextcloud, as well as Bitwarden. Bitwarden, we talked on episode 3, that's a password manager. It's open source as well. But Nextcloud is an app that you can install through this, basically this Umbrel web application. So you could kind of maybe do like this download, set it up on a, you know, $50, $80 Raspberry Pi, set it up with a, you know, 4 or 5 terabyte drive. Yeah, it's going to store the Bitcoin blockchain on a copy of it on this drive, but you'll also have the rest of the drive if you want to use it for Nextcloud, maybe just to tinker with before you figure out if you're going to set this up full time. One thing to note is if you do set up your Nextcloud server in your house, which is pretty cool, and it's totally free because, you know, other than buying the hardware, if you want to access it from the outside, from your mobile phone, you're sitting at a coffee shop or restaurant, and you want to pull up that photo, you will need to set up your networking configuration to do port forwarding on your router, which is actually not that hard. And then the other thing you'll want to make sure to do is, have some sort of backup solution, because it does live in your house. So if your house were to flood or have a fire, heaven forbid, if you were using that to store like your files and it was the only place, then you're kind of screwed. So you kind of maybe want to do some sort of backup for that, or a rotation of, hey, I back up my drive once a month and I keep it at, your family member or a friend's house or something tucked away somewhere where you can always get a backup of all your stuff. One of the benefits of hosting on the cloud is you can, set up snapshots and you do your backups and they're all pretty much automated and you don't really have to worry about running anything in your house. There's pros and cons to both of those. Someone might say, well, that's someone else's server. You're 100% right. It is. It's somebody else's server. But the difference is that it's a server that I'm root on. It's a server that I've set up with end-to-end encryption on. It's a server that I can monitor and I can see who's logged onto the box. I have full control over it. I am paying for it, so therefore I have full access. I pay for iCloud and I have zero access. I don't know who's accessing my folder. I don't have any. It's all black box, right? So I don't really have anything. I just have to blindly trust that Apple isn't going to do me wrong. I don't know when they scan my stuff. I don't know if someone's tried to access it from inside Apple. There's no way to know, because all you're giving is what they allow you to see, which is the cute little icons and, you log in and you can see your stuff. I really don't think anyone at Apple gives a shit about me, so I'm not really that concerned. I'm just saying in general, if you're not in control of the data, somebody else is. So at a high level, that's kind of where I wanted to bring everybody in, was like there's definitely a desire for companies to have more and more access to your information, and where your files are stored should be really important to you to understand like how that could be used now and down the road. But at the same time, I don't want to mitigate the challenge or the fear that a lot of people have when trying to go backwards and do it on their own. 10 years ago, 10, even just 10, 15 years ago, it was pretty common for people to buy external storage devices and back up all their photos too. And it was kind of a pain, but you didn't realize it was a pain because it's just what you did. Now doing that would be a gigantic pain, because you'd be thinking to yourself, why don't I just, upload it to the cloud, right? And I agree, it is a pain. So my pitch is upload it to your cloud, right? And it doesn't have to be Nextcloud. Nextcloud is just what I'm using. It could be an appliance. There are some off the shelf appliances you can buy. Network attached storage devices are called NAS servers that you can put on your network. And these are actually great. I actually have a NAS for other things like video editing files and stuff like that. It can be very, very useful. And some of them even have the ability to run applications on them, Nextcloud being one of them. There's another variant, which is called OwnCloud, OWN. So that might come up if you're like looking around. I have a little experience with OwnCloud, but the last time I had set that up was probably 4 or 5 years ago. And I actually first set it up way, way back when as a groupware server. I think it was called GroupWise or something like that. It was a variant of OwnCloud to use for basically business, a business suite. I've set up a lot of open source suites in the past, like Sugar CRM. There's a variant of that called Suite CRM. Now, that's pretty cool if you do run a business and you want your own open source customer relation management tool, which is what CRM is. Those are some good projects to take a look at. Haven't actually used it in a few years, but the last big one I did was for a pretty big organization, and we did a custom setup of Suite CRM, which has some really enhanced features over Sugar. But, these are open source projects. Nextcloud is an open source project. Cryptomator is an open source project. And why do I emphasize open source? Why do I keep saying that over and over again? Because the code for the application is available. They're on GitHub. They're reviewed. There's a lot of people who use these applications that are constantly making improvements. And because the code is openly available, security issues get patched really quickly, and features and enhancements get written quite often and are uploaded, as opposed to using closed source applications that you don't have access to. So you just have to hope for the best and hope that there's no major security flaws or breaches. So that's why I emphasize open source. The more open source software you can implement in your life, the more free you'll be, the more you can rely on the community as opposed to a company, especially for-profit companies. So that's, you know, that's kind of where my mindset is if I want to accomplish a task, is there an open source software tool that I can use in lieu of, say, Photoshop, or in lieu of, now, and sometimes there's not, right? And I'm not necessarily talking about from a professional standpoint, but definitely in your personal life. So there are some other services that provide just the data storage, I should say, or file storage. So I cover Trezorit. There's IceDrive, pCloud, Mega, surprisingly, and that was on TechLore's list, which they actually offer zero-knowledge storage. And I kind of like, you know, there's been some drama with Mega in the past, but they seem to have a pretty good offering, and they publish their source code to make it available for people to take a look at. So that's pretty cool. One thing of note is, you know, going back to the whole privacy, what, you know, if I'm not doing anything, or, you know, I have nothing to hide kind of thing, is I was actually watching a TED Talk, and I personally kind of can't stand TED Talks, but this one was actually pretty decent. It was done in 2019, I think, maybe 2020. A gentleman by the name of Nelio Leon. He's Italian, and he was part of a startup back in 2017, where they built their business using a growth hacking technique, which is basically a company that is taking an amount of data and doing a lot of rapid multivariate testing with data for content and stuff to get psychological profiles of individuals so they could learn how to market products and services. And, you know, he actually had a pretty good talk, because he was a big time, like, privacy is dead, why bother? If you're going to use these services, you just have to understand that your data is going to be freely available and used for whatever. But what he didn't know is, you know, they actually were using a lot of these growth hacking techniques pre-Cambridge Analytica scandal in 2018 during the Trump election. And, you know, on the other side of that, he's done work with other startups. One of them was Quara, Q-W-A-R-A, which is in Africa, which was a kind of a business startup to help younger people manage their money and avoid predatory lending, because in Africa, in certain parts of Africa especially, there's no, or at the time, there wasn't any real privacy regulation. So what was happening was these predatory lending companies would make it really easy for people to borrow money through an app. Well, these apps, what they would do is you download and install it. You would accept the terms and conditions, which part of that was also accessing pretty much like all the data on your phone, including your contacts and all that. And I'm sure if you've ever downloaded an app and installed it, especially a social media app, they try to get access to your contacts. They try to get access to your photos and everything. They try to get access to your contacts so they can say, like, well, let's just see if any of your friends are on here. And your mind's like, yeah, that makes sense. But what you're really doing is you're giving access of all your contacts to this company. You don't know who the hell they are. Well, this happens with this app, with these apps for these lending services, which some of these lending services charge as much as 147% interest. And so what happens is these borrowers are not, if they miss their payment by like one day, the companies basically shame them by sending text messages to everyone in their contact book saying that you have defaulted, you are facing legal liability or legal, you know, action. Basically, they're saying they're going to threaten to sue you if they don't get your payment. And so they're trying to notify all your contacts to basically work on their behalf to notify you, being like, hey, man, I just got a text message that says you're buying on a payment and that you might be facing legal action. That's humiliating. That's shameful. Now, is that person doing a criminal act? No. But by allowing the sharing of all this access of their mobile device to this lending app, that lending service now has all this information about them, including all their contacts, and they contact them. Now, that doesn't happen in a lot of Western world countries because of regulation, but the same practice still applies, but it's used in different ways. So accessing those contacts, accessing your files, which includes a lot of your geotagging information, like where you were when you took the photo, like, who you may be tagged, who you're with. Instagram, it has been notorious at this, right? The red herring was that they were going to allow the sale or the use of your photos for commercial purposes, where Instagram would get paid and you would not. So you don't technically own your photo anymore once you put it on Instagram, even though you're saying like, well, that's my photo, I took it with my phone. True, but you published it on a platform that had terms and conditions around the content you post on there and what they can do with it. So you're using their platform to get your content in front of potentially millions of people and to get interactions and to promote yourself. And in return, they get access to your contacts. They get to utilize your work, your photos, potentially for marketing purposes or to be used with other companies that want to use that image. Like if you took a really cool picture of a lake or a scenic shot like landscape or something like, a beautiful sunset, they can use that. And other companies can use it to make money where you will not make any. Even though I'm talking about Nextcloud, we're talking about data storage, we're talking about storing your files and your pictures and all this kind of thing, is I just want people to be cognizant about what they're using and what do they benefit out of it and what does the service benefit from you utilizing your platform. You realize if everyone stopped posting on Instagram tomorrow, Instagram would be worthless because they make their money from advertisers marketing to people. And by you contributing, and I'm not bashing on you for anyone using Instagram. I'm just simply stating, like, I'm just using them as an example, is that, they're all encompassing and tracking you to curate better ads and fire at the right time, even based on your emotions. And there's a reason why Facebook went away from the like and went to the emojis. Smiley, happy, yay, cry, sad, mad, because they can gauge sentiment, they can gauge emotion, they can see patterns, and they can optimize ad placement based upon your mood, your interactions, your search history, your friends, your groups, everything that you're connected to. And this trickles from Instagram to Facebook and even into conversations that are happening in WhatsApp. So when I'm talking about using these tools, I'm not talking about just to safeguard your data, your files, but also to safeguard the profiling on you. On the previous episode, we talked about using MySudo, creating pseudo accounts when you sign up for rewards programs. Obfuscate your identity. You have no obligation to give anyone really any real information, and you don't have to feel bad about it. And this is your life. This is your profile. And this will matter more and more as time goes on with this, surveillance, what I labeled the episode, surveillance capitalism, right? They're able to market products and services to you that you're more likely to buy because they know what your mind frame is. They know your emotion. They know your patterns. They know your friends. They know your interests. So you're helping them opt up. And a lot of people will say, well, it's cool because I get the best kinds of ads. Yeah, you're 100% right, because they're optimizing the algorithms and the ad platforms to publish that content in front of you at the very moment that you're most compelled to buy that product, right? Yes, it's by design. And if you like that, I mean, that's awesome. And I'm not saying that that in itself is inherently bad, but the trade-off is that that's what they're doing today. They're collecting all this information, but we don't know what they'll be doing with it tomorrow, a month from now, 3 years from now. what the state of government will be. I'm not trying to get dystopian or anything. I'm just talking about the realities, especially that I've witnessed just in the last decade. And I kind of used the last decade. It's 2021. So going back to 2011, a few years after the first iPhone came out, smartphones were just getting popular around that time. And not when I say popular, I mean like almost everyone had one at that point. And now it's like you, most people have a phone who don't even have a computer because they just use their phone for everything, or maybe a tablet. So it's become such an integrated component of our life. And we don't know how this, you know, how these entities will use our information and our data down the road. There's actually a clip I want to play for you real quick. And it's actually from this particular individual that I just mentioned earlier. This, I don't know if I'm messing up his name, Nelio Leone. He's from Southern Italy. And he's talking about, I just kind of want to talk about this, or demonstrate this growth hacking so that you can kind of understand and hear the enthusiasm in his voice talking about how they were using this data back in 2017 and, you know, for the startup. So let's give it a listen.
Hi, guys. Has anyone here ever heard about growth hacking? So in the world of startups where I work, growth hacking is the art of growing a company as fast as possible with very little budget. How do we do this? By combining data with rapid experimentation, we get to understand the behavior of users. We get to understand their psychology. We get to understand what is going to work for you or what is not going to work for you. We're going to understand what you're going to like and what you're going to dislike. Growth hacking is exciting. And in 2017, at least for me personally, it was like the golden age of growth hacking. Why? Because it was very easy to gather data, to combine it, and I was able to put the right content in front of the right people at the right time on the right channel. Guys, it was exciting because I felt more than honing a skill, I felt I was developing a superpower. Yeah.
Developing a superpower. That's what the takeaway I want you to have from this is that that's essentially what these companies are, are where they're positioning themselves is to be more powerful than even governments. Governments, I mean, even though we have a lot of information from WikiLeaks and Snowden and all this stuff about illegal surveillance, bulk data collection, it's still understood, or we're supposed to understand, that in order to investigate you or take information from you, there has to be some kind of a warrant, there has to be cause, and there's a process in place. But with corporations, their rules don't apply, those laws don't apply where there is an end user license agreement, or there's an agreement between them as a company, a for-profit company in most cases, and you as a user of their platform. So when you agree to those terms and conditions, you are basically creating a social contract with them, if you will. That whereas now the law doesn't apply as it does to the government in order to get your data, because now you're just going to freely give it to them by using their service. So you become the product of their service to sell to marketers, ad agencies, third parties, and things like that. So that's the whole basis for this title, surveillance capitalism, is that it's, I mean, it may be a little dark, but that's what it is, you know, with Amazon Alexa and Google. I mean, you name it, dozens or hundreds of products and services that are basically surveilling you for the purpose of selling to you. So the more you can reel back in, the less you are giving them that power, that superpower. You're taking that superpower back, so to speak. And that's kind of where I want to leave off with this episode. I'll have links to the podcast, or links in the podcast show notes to a lot of the things that I'm talking about. I also have some interesting little articles. I don't know if, you know, if you want to look, but there's, you know, as it pertains to surveillance capital that I didn't cover necessarily in this podcast, but I'll just give you a quick tidbit, which is basically companies have even used this meta information to charge people different prices. Wall Street Journal, BBC, CNET, ABC News, I'll have links to all of them where it talks about companies like Orbitz and hotels and car rental companies charging, and even airline websites charging Apple iPhone and Mac users more money, up to 30% more than Android users, because they kind of figure you can afford it. Because if you can afford a $1,200 phone, you can afford a 30% tax on your airfare or your hotel, simply based on the device you're using. So it can even cost you additional money based on what you're using. And I'm not, you know, none of this is like, and it sounds dystopian, but it's like, this is real. And some of these articles are actually, are pretty old. But it's just another area to highlight why it's really important to understand what companies are doing with your profile and how they're structuring the message to get you to buy a product or a service. And in some cases, you might be paying a premium for it because they think you can afford it. So I'll have those links up in the show notes. I have the website set up, which is closednetworknwrk.com. So that's closednwrk.com. That's where all the podcasts are. You can, all the subscription stuff. I'm also working on some blog articles. I have one up so far. There's a donation link. I'm a huge fan of the value for value model, which is, you know, if you want to, you know, make a donation or something, because we don't take any sponsorships, we're not going to do any commercials. It's just pure donations. We're going to be selling de-Googled phones, so I'm working on that as well. That's another part of the website. But you can go there, you can donate crypto, you can buy me a coffee and give me a tip or whatever if you feel compelled. I greatly appreciate that. You can also leave reviews on the website or through your favorite podcast app. That helps me out a lot. Helps spread the exposure and get more attention to this topic. And yeah, I really appreciate that. So feel free to check out the site and take a look at trying to implement something maybe in the next week or two. Maybe just try out Cryptomator and see if that's something that, you know, could work for you as far as encrypting your files. Maybe start there. That'd be a really simple thing you could do right away. And maybe then start looking at, you know, upgrading to something you host yourself. I will be working on some tutorials on our YouTube channel on how to actually set up a lot of these things I'm talking about. So thanks for listening, everyone. Hope you are all doing well, and I will catch you in the next podcast.